Good evening, Shalom. I'm going to take off my jacket. I want to first thank Dina Gottlieb, the Gottlieb family, and the Meisels family, who do chesed, whose life is doing chesed for other people and helping other people, and make shiurim on their rooftops in Har Nov and in Kiryat Sefer. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm very misragish when you say that this evening is dedicated to Rabbi Bulman, because I knew Rabbi Bulman well, and he was always very, very, very nice to me. He was exceptionally nice to me. And whenever he would see me, he would come over to me. I was much younger than him. He would come over to me, and he would grab my hand, and very, very warmly. I met on the plane once, and he sat with me. He said, "Where are you sitting?" He changed his seat to sit with me. And I asked him, "Why are you so nice to me?" I said, "You've always been so very, very kind to me. You've always mekarev me." And he said, "People think," he says, "that it's a mitzvah only to be mekarev people who are far away." The mekarev v'chaykim, he said. He said, "But it's also a very, very big mitzvah," he said, "to be mekarev people who come from homes where their father is a very, very great goyin." He said, "As your father is, Reb Chaim Yankiv." He said, "A tzaddik like your grandfather." He said, "People don't always understand how important it is also to be mekarev somebody who comes from a home where there are big gedolim and big rabbanim. What a burden it is sometimes to a person who comes from a home like that." Nobody had ever said anything like that to me. And I really felt with him that he understood that it's not an easy thing when you come from a home of big rabbanim and big tzaddikim, and when you're a young person, people expect of you, and people always say to you, what is the grandson, what is the son? I had a very big Rosh Hashiva in America. I remember years ago, on the first day in Yeshiva, I said a svara, and he said to me in front of the entire class, "Dein Tate vol kemol nisht gezogt azeh." Your father would never have said something like that. I don't have to tell you what that did for me for the entire year. I went home saying, "I wish my father would have been a shoemaker or a cobbler or whatever. Then I could say any svara I want and it would be okay." And I always felt with him that he understood that it's important not only to be makar of people who are far away, that people who are very close sometimes, it's a mitzvah to be makar of them as well. And I always appreciated him for it. He was a very exceptional human being. People always ask me whenever I appear anywhere, the first question always is how Rabbi Aryeh Levine's son speaks English, as in an American, a grandson. How could it be that Rabbi Aryeh Levine has a grandson that speaks English? My father was one of the Gedolim of Yerushalayim. My father, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, with childhood chavrusas in Eitz Chaim, Yeshiva, and Rehov Yafo. My father was Reb Chaim Yankiv. He was known in Yerushalayim as a young boy, one of the Iluim of Yerushalayim. My mother came from London as a young girl. Her father was a Rav in London, and they were married in Eretz Yisrael. And after a year or two, my grandfather, Reb Aryeh, said to my father, "Midavgen zendem shvel. It's already 2 years. It's time to go visit your father-in-law as a Rav in London." So they went to London, and Reb Meir Berlin, the son of the Netziv, Reb Meir Berlin, a younger brother of Reb Chaim Berlin, said to my father, he at that time was in London, and he said to my father, "I never would tell you to leave Eretz Yisrael, but if you're ready here in England, I want you to go to America for a few weeks and give a number of shiurim that people should hear you in America as well." And my father had just written a sefer on the Rambam on Kochim, and he didn't have any parnas in England. My mother was with her family there, so my father went to America. And while he was in America, World War II broke out, and you couldn't travel. It was very, very difficult to travel over the ocean. Boats were sunk. And a few weeks that my father thought they'd be in America eventually turned out to be 30 years. And he was a Rav there. He started a yeshiva in America. And as a young boy, he would send me in the summers to live with my grandfather in Yerushalayim. I'm talking about the late 50s, early 60s. Yerushalayim was very, very small then. Very, very different than it is today. But I was zeicha to live with my grandfather in the little room that he lived in. His wife had passed away many years before him. And I was zeicha to live with him in his little room. He used to make breakfast for me on his little primus. I remember, and then learn with me, and then take me to different places that he went to. And I was really zeicha to see him up close, to see him when nobody else saw him. And I can say that the persona that he was when no one saw him, and the same persona that he was on the outside, was the same person. Very often, public people have a different persona that they put on when they're outside in front of people. But with him, it was the same person. The person you saw up close when no one was around, and the person you saw outside in public was really the same person. And he had a tremendous hashpoya on my life. There's no question that many of the things that I do today and are the things that I received from him. The pashtus, the simplicity, there was something very, very normal. You know, you expect that when you go to visit a tzaddik, you want to see what are the things that he's going to do that are different than everyone else so that you can write it up and then later do those things. That's what I thought. The first time I went, I said, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael, and I'm going to be able to see now, mamish, to live with the tzaddik of Yerushalayim. I'm going to take notes, and when I go back to America, I'm going to do the things that I saw the tzaddik did. And when my friends in yeshiva say to me, why are you doing this? I'll say, that's what tzaddikim do. And it was very, very difficult to find unusual things. Everything was very simple, was very poshut. To look to him, to say that he davened in a special way or different, everything was so simple. It was hard to find something that I could say, this is, except when it came to the way that he related to other people. And the first story that I ever heard from him, and I like to tell stories. I think that you sometimes teach more by telling stories than you do by giving all kinds of difficult rayonot or whatever. That sometimes the simplicity of a story, like the old Magidim did, sometimes talks more than anything else and is a bigger limud than anything else. And the first story I heard from him was a story many of you may have heard, but it was a story that I heard from him, and to me is the essential story of what chesed is, of how we should relate to other people. And it happened Leil Shabbat. I was looking forward to the first Shabbos. What is the Shabbos meal going to be like in the home of the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim? Now, on Leil Shabbat, since his wife had passed away, the entire week he lived in a little room downstairs on the little street that today bears his name. But on Shabbos, he would go up to eat with his daughter. He had a number of daughters who were living in the courtyard. He had a yeshiva there, Beis Aryeh. And he would eat with one of his daughters and their family, all the children around the table. His son-in-law was also a very, very big tzaddik, Rav Aaron Yakubovich, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha. And I expected in my mind that the Leil Shabbat, the Friday evening meal with the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, is going to be something so spiritual that I'm never going to forget it. It's going to be full of Limud Torah. It's going to be full of Zmiris. It's going to be something that you never forget. You see it once, you never forget. And the truth is, I was a bit disappointed because we went up these stone steps in the Chatzer to his daughter's little apartment, whatever you'll call it. And the meal went very quickly. There was a few divrei Torah, there was a little zmiris, but it went very, very quickly. And before we knew, we were finished and we were going back to his little room. And apparently he saw that I was a little disappointed. So he said to me, Binyamin Ke, he says, Vosis. So I said to him, I tell you the truth, Zaid, I said in Yiddish, I said, I expected to see much more. I was looking for, he said, well, you know, he said, my daughter has a very big family. It's very hard for her the entire week. He said, but let's go into my room, we'll have a cup of tea, and then I'll tell you a story. And the story he told me was a story I'm sure many of you have heard, but it's a story that if I had one story only to tell of what really Jewish ethics and Musar is, I would tell only this story. It was the story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was a relative of his. And he said, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, when he was an old man, he had his yeshiva, his koilel, and one of his students invited him to the Friday evening meal to come and be with him, Leil Shabbat at the meal. This was a very big honor if the Rebbe will come himself to be with them at the meal, a little very big covet for them. The Rebbe said that it's hard for him now to leave his house on Friday night, Leil Shabbat. It's difficult for him, but if the student will tell him what he does, how he prepares the meals, what happens in his house, then he'll give him an answer. And the student understood this to mean that if he says the right things, and the Rebbe will like it, maybe the Rebbe will come to be with him, and that's a very, very big covet. So he said, first of all, in terms of the Kashrus Rebbe, he said, you don't have to worry. He said, my wife checks and rechecks everything. He said, nothing passes her that shouldn't be there. He said, and what about, how do you prepare the meal, he said, for Shabbos? He said, well, there's a young woman, a widow. Her husband was a Talmud Chacham. He passed away at a young age. And she was left alone. And I wanted to offer her staka to help her, and she didn't want to take any charity. She didn't want charity. So I said, maybe you'll come and work in my house. We have a lot of guests. We have a big family. A lot of people come to us for Shabbos. I need somebody to take care of the kitchen, somebody who knows all the halachas. And I'll pay you and you'll have a place to live in our house. That she was willing to do. She said, if I can come and work for my upkeep, that I'm willing to do. So she takes care of the kitchen. She knows exactly what to do. She serves the meals. She's in charge of the kitchen. Says, how does she prepare the Shabbos meal, the Rebbe said. Said, she gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning on Friday morning, and she starts to bake and to cook, especially in the wintertime, when Shabbos comes in early, at 4 o'clock or even before, and we have a lot of guests, there's a lot of work to do. So she gets up very, very early in the morning, and she starts to bake and to cook and to do everything that's needed. And what happened, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, when you come back from Shul on Leil Shabbat, so he says, when we come into the house, Rabbi said, if you'll come once, you want to come again. He said, first we come into the house, the candles are lit, the table is set, everything is ready. We say good Shabbos each one to the other. And then we start singing Shalom Aleichem, it takes us about a half hour. Then we sing Eishes Chayil, it takes us about another half hour. Then we go to the table, we make Kiddush, we wash our hands, make a moitzi, and then we open up the Parshat Shavua, and we study for about a half hour, 45 minutes, Parshat Shavua. Then the young widow brings the first course, the fish. After the fish, we open up the Zmiris, and we sing for another hour. Then she brings the soup. After the soup, we open up a Mishnayis, and we learn for another hour or so. Then she brings the chicken, and the meal goes to the late, late hours of the night, sometimes the early morning Shabbos itself. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter hears all this and says, Taka, that's what you do? If that's the case, I'll be in your house next week. The student was overjoyed. Kanareh, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter liked very much the idea that this is an atmosphere of learning, of Torah, of Mamish, a Shabbos atmosphere. Matzachein beinat. I don't have to tell you that the entire week, the student checked all the mezuzahs in the house and did everything that had to be done so that when Yisrael comes, everything will be perfect. Comes the next Leil Shabbat, Friday night, they come back from Shul, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is with them, and everybody in the neighborhood is looking at Rebbe Gate, and he's going with them into their house. What a covet. They come into the house, everything is set, the table's set, the candles are lit. They say good Shabbos, they start singing Shalom Aleichem, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter goes right to the table, pours the wine in the becher, and gets up to make Kiddush. The student doesn't understand, but he thinks to himself, maybe he didn't eat the whole day, as many people till today. Righteous people, they don't eat on Friday so that they can come to the Shabbos meal with a teavon of Shabbos, of how you should really eat a Shabbos meal. So they figured it's hard for him, he's an old man. So if Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is making Kiddush, his student's not going to start singing Shalom Aleichem, that's not Derech Eretz. So that week they dispense with Shalom Aleichem and with Eishes Chayil. They go all to the table and they make Kiddush. They finish making Kiddush, they wash their hands, they make a moitzi. Everybody already opens up their chumashim, each one their different chumash, whatever they have. And Rabbi Yisrael says, please bring out the fish. So he figured the student that a little bit of wine and a little bit of bread is not enough. After you're fasting a whole day, you need something in your stomach. The Rebbe is eating the fish, they're not going to be sitting and learning. So they close the chumashim, and they all eat the fish. They finish the fish. They open up the zmiris to sing. And Rabbi Yisrael says, please bring out the soup. Rabbi Yisrael, the Rebbe is going to eat the soup. It's not nice that they're going to be singing. They close the zmiris and they all eat the soup. They finish the soup. They open up the mishnayis. And Rabbi Yisrael says to bring out the chicken. In a half hour or so, they finish the entire meal. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wants to bench and he wants to go home. The student couldn't take this anymore. He said, Rebbe, the whole time he said, I was quiet. I didn't say a word. I didn't say anything. He said, my Rebbe, you're my Rebbe. Whatever you do is, by me, is Kodesh. He said, but is something wrong? He said, we don't eat like this during the week. He said, even during the week, if we eat by the meal, somebody says a Dvar Torah or whatever, and here is Vachalta V'Savata U'Barachta, and you're ready now to leave. You want to leave right away? He said, what's wrong? So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, where is the young lady who was serving the meals? He said, she's sitting over there on the side. He said, call her over for a minute. Comes over and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says to her, I beg your pardon, I beg apology. He said, I'm sorry, he said. She says, why? He said, I heard that every Shabbos between each course, you have time to rest, to sit down. And I came here and I asked you to bring out one course right after the other. You didn't have a minute for yourself. She said, Rebbe, sollt ihr sein gesund, Sollte kommen jeden Shabbos. I wish you would be here every Shabbos. She said, why? She said, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning on Friday morning to start preparing the meal. There's a lot of work to do. Comes the evening, Yech Falshin from the Fizz, I'm falling off my feet, I can't take it anymore. He said, if then your student, who's my balabais, my balabas, he comes and he starts opening up another sefer and another sefer and another sefer. And I'm saying to myself, Shalom, when will he finish already? And so that I can finish what I have to do and go to sleep. I'm up since 5 o'clock in the morning. It goes till so late, Yechav Shinishkin Kaya, I can't take it anymore. She said, a new Rebbe, you came here tonight, you finished everything in a short time, now for the first time in a long time, I can finish what I have to do, and I can go to sleep like a mensch. When she finished talking, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta turned to his Talmud, the Balabas, and said to him, now do you understand why I came here? He said, I don't need your food. The food in my house is as kosher as yours. He said, but when you were telling me how you open up another sefer and another sefer, I was thinking, what about that young lady who's up since 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, a whole day standing on her feet preparing? Said, you want to be a very fine person, you want to sit and learn it. That's a wonderful thing, but not at the cheshbon of somebody else. So the student said, so what should I have done? He said, what do you mean? I shouldn't learn on Shabbos? I shouldn't sing Zmiris? Rebbe said, I didn't say that. On Shabbos you should learn, you should sing Zmiris. He said, so what should I have done though? He said, what do you mean what should you have done? He said, you should have told her to go to sleep, and when you finish the meal, you get up and finish the dishes and prepare whatever has to be prepared. What do you mean, what should you have done? That to me is the essence of what the Torah is all about. Because you can learn Torah, and you can learn for years, and you can be an Adam Gadol. But it's not only the Torah you learn. It's not learning the Torah, it's what the Torah has taught you, and what the Torah has made you. And if as a result of learning, you lose your sensitivity to other people around, and you don't have the feeling for an almana that's standing on her feet for a whole day because you're sitting and learning, then there's something wrong with the way that you're learning. Because the Torah has to teach you edelkeit as well. The Torah has to teach you how to relate to other people. I always say that the first word of the Aseres HaDibros is Anochi, I. The last word of the Aseres HaDibros is L'Reyecha. The entire Aseres HaDibros is sandwiched between the words Anochi L'Reyecha. How do I relate to another human being? Also, I love this story because it's a very educational chinuchi story. Because when this person came to Rabbi Yisrael Salanta and told him what he does, when Rabbi Yisrael Salanta asked him, how do you prepare the meal, and told him the whole story, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta at the moment could have said to him, that's not right. What about this almona is up since 5 o'clock in the morning? Rabbi Yisrael Salanta understood that if he says it to him, maybe he'll understand, maybe he won't. But if he goes to his house, and he changes over the whole Seder of his evening, everybody in that household, his wife and his children, will always remember, there was one night that we didn't sing Zmiris, and we didn't learn very much at the table, and the meal went very, very quickly. And why? Because the Rebbe came himself and was with us, and he wanted to teach us how we should relate to that almana that's standing in the kitchen since 5 o'clock in the morning. That is the essence of Yiddishkeit. The essence of Yiddishkeit is how we relate to other people. It's not enough to learn Torah if the Torah doesn't teach us how we should relate to other people. This is the first lesson I learned by my Zayde Rabbi Aryeh Levine. How do you relate to another person? His daughter, he understood, had a big family. She worked hard. And he said, I'm going to go up now and sit for a few hours when she is falling off her feet after she prepared and worked for a whole week. That was the sensitivity that he had to other people. There are many, many things I saw with my Zayde that were very, very simple things. But I learned from him, from those simple things, that's what Yiddishkeit is all about. I learned from him what Kedusha is all about. I want to tell you, when I was a young person, before I was married, I used to imagine in my mind, what is my Shabbos table going to be like when I get married? And I would think to myself, what will my Shabbos table be like? And I would midamyen, and I would fantasize in my mind that I would be sitting Shabbos opposite my wife. I would get married. I would sit opposite my wife. And the Shabbos table would be pure ruchnius. It would be the whole week we would wait to just go up and up spiritually. We would say zmiris. We would say divrei Torah to each other. And it would be a wonderful thing to sit opposite my wife in my own little room in my home after I'm married. And Baruch Hashem, I got married. And the first year of marriage was wonderful. We had a little apartment that was very, very hard to even get into. It was very, very small. You had to open up the table, and when the table was open, you couldn't move anywhere. In order to move, you had to close the table. It was a very small table. But we sat opposite each other, and we said Divrei Torah. And it was a very, very holy, it was real Kedusha. We sat opposite each other. Thank you very much. We sat opposite each other, and it was Kedusha, and we said Divrei Torah. And I always felt Shabbos gave me koyach to go through the whole week. That was real Kedusha of a Shabbos table. About a year ago, I'm sitting in shul, Leil Shabbat, and I have a rayon. I thought of a rayon of a vort to say on the Pashat Shavua, and I thought it was a good vort because everybody thinks their vertlach are the best. And I'm going to come home now, and I'm going to sit around my table, and it's not now this little table where I'm sitting opposite my wife. They're now 10 children, Kanaina Hora, around the table. And I'm going to say this Dvar Torah that I thought of. And it's going to be real ruchnius, real holiness, the way that I always thought it would be. And I come home, and we make Kiddush, and we're sitting around the table, and I'm about to give over my Dvar Torah that I thought is going to wow everybody, and all the kids are going to wonder, it's going to be great. And I start to say over my Dvar Torah, and in the middle, one of the kids drops the fish on the floor. Another kid spills the soup on somebody else. And I'm coming into the end of my Dvar Torah, the most important part of the Dvar Torah, and my wife asked me to go change the diaper of the baby because she's in the middle with the other things that have to be taken care of. And I looked at all of this and I said, was ist geworden von mein Stub? What happened to my Stub, to my family, my home? The home that I dreamed about that would be full of Torah, that would be holiness and everything, and ruchnius and everything on Shabbos, what happened to that home? Here I am coming home, I'm saying this Dvar Torah, which is supposed to be the height of the whole Shabbos table, and in the middle, this one, I have to go change a diaper in the middle. That's my ruchnius. And I sat down at the table, and I took this all in for a while. I watched the whole scene, and then, for the first time, I understood what real Kedusha is of a Shabbos table. I understood for the first time what the Rabbeinu Shlalem wants from me. The Rabbeinu Shlalem can live without my Dvar Torah. It's not that it's not important to say a Dvar Torah, it is important to say a Dvar Torah. But I realized what the Rabbeinu Shlalem wants more than anything else is a normal table where people sit around the table and kids do the things that normal kids do, because that's what kids do. The tafkid of children is to drop fish on the floor, to spill soup on one another. You have to change your diaper. That is normal. That's what living is all about. That's really what the Rabbeinu Shlalem wants of me. Without my Dvar Torah, he can manage. But he wants a table where children are sitting around the table and they're happy. They wait a whole week to be around that Shabbos table because it's a wonderful place to be. And it's not the atmosphere where the kids have to sit there and they have to cringe because they tell him now Abba's giving his Dvar Torah and they don't know what he's talking about and they have to sit for a half hour and they don't even know what it is and it's the most miserable experience in the world. And afterwards, what he remembers afterwards his whole life is how this miserable experience was when he had to sit quiet and listen to a half hour of the Dvar Torah. He didn't even know what they were talking about this well. Rabbeinu Shlalem wants a happy table, a happy home. He wants a kid to be able to come home from yeshiva on Shabbos and to sit around the table where if he goes away from the table and plays in the middle or something, he doesn't get it over the head. And his memories are what a wonderful time it was for us to sit around that Shabbos table, that happiness of everybody being happy and kind and nice to one another. That's the Shabbos, the wonderful memories of Shabbos. That's what the Rabbeinu Shlalem wants for us. It's the normalcy that we forget, and I can tell you, I was zoich in my life to meet a lot of gedolim of the past generation. Not because of my own zchuyot. Because I happened to have a zchus of being born into the right family. And I was zoich to see many of the gedolim of the past generation. They were wonderful, kind people. Their chumras, I never heard their chumras. I just knew that they related to every person. They were kind to every person. And they made you feel that to be able to relate, to see a gadol is a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, we do a terrible thing today. There are mistakes that have been made in this generation that we will pay the price, we're paying the price for, and we'll continue to pay the price for. One of them is that we put out books for young children about gedolim, and all these gedolim at the age of 2 weeks, they're already saying brachas, they're already learning Torah, and they're already Gedolim. And you know what that does to a kid? What that does to a kid who wants to be an Adam Gadol and has a shi'ifan, a drive to be a Talmud Chacham, what that does to that young person is it says to him, if you at the age of 2 weeks were not making brachas and learning Mishnayos, you'll never be able to make it. What a terrible yiush. What a terrible thing it is when a kid says, I want to be a Gadol, but if the Gedolim were like that so young, then how can I ever be a Gadol? Ani mityaesh, I'll never be able to be like it, I'll try to be something else. Why can't we tell the truth? Sure, there were exceptions. But why can't we tell the truth and say, you know, there were great Gedolim in Am Yisrael when they were young kids, they were shtiffers, they made tzoras a little bit, they didn't do everything they should do, but they learned from their mistakes, and then later on they became big Gedolim. You know what that would do to a young person reading it? He would say, wow, that Gadol was also what a young person is shtiffer, and he got into trouble, and the Rebbe yelled at him sometime and everything else. That means I'm normal. That means I also one day could be a Gadol like this other person. And I'm telling you, we're going to pay a price. We're paying a price for it now, and we will continue to pay a price for it. And a person who will come out with a sefer on Gedolim that tells about how when they were young kids, they were shtiffers and made mischief, and they got into trouble, and they got in, the rebbes yelled at them. A person will put out a sefer like that. He will kovesh all the young people around today. Because they'll be able to say, this is real, this is human. And I can identify with something like that. We have to, normalcy is the tzav hasha'ah. If I go around making these, talking these talks, I enjoy giving shiurim and learning. One of the reasons I go around giving these talks, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was my father's chavrusa, as a young boy, my father, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, were childhood chavrusas in Yerushalayim and Eitz Chaim. They learned together from the same Gemara. I saw with Reb Shlomo Zalman, and I saw with my father, the way they related to other people. I saw when they went to be Menachem Oval, how they always went into the room of the women and talked to them for a few minutes. I saw at a simcha, they went over on the side of the mechitza and said mazel tov to the women and to the mother and to the baba and other people. They were such normal people. They didn't have their frumkeit. They were greater tzaddikim than all the tzaddikim today with all the chumras that are around. And Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said to me, he said, du darfst da rumgehen und darfst erzählen de meises wegen dein Seiden. He said, what you have to do is go around and tell the stories. I said, yeah, but it's going to take away time from my learning. He said, that's what you have to do. Every person has a tafkid in life. He said, what I'm telling you to do is you have to go around, tell these stories. That people should understand that Yiddishkeit means being normal. It doesn't mean being mishuge. And that's not what the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants from us. And these are the stories, the things that I saw with my Zedim, with Reb Arya, with all these gedolim, was the normalcy, how normal these people were. And we lose that sometimes. And it really is a tzav hasha'ah. It's really something that we should all go around and be telling everybody else and not forget it. Because that's where we've lost the essence of Yiddishkeit. We've made Yiddishkeit into something that it wasn't. Yiddishkeit was user-friendly. In America, they talk about user-friendly. Being frum was user-friendly. It was something you were proud to be in a time when people weren't very, very frum. Anybody who grew up in the 50s in America knows what it meant. When you didn't grow up like Shchunot today, where everybody was frum and everything, you didn't have any of these things. But being a frum was user-friendly. You were proud of being frum. It was normal, it was happy, it made you happy. And if doing these things makes your house miserable, then there's something wrong with what you're doing. Then it's not what Yiddishkeit intended it to be. If all you feel when you come to Shabbos is lachatz, and everything, and you don't enjoy the Shabbos of what it should be, something's wrong with the way that you're doing it. By my grandfather, I saw the importance of how little things are, how important little things are. The little mitzvahs of things, of how important they are. There was one story that happened to me 30 years ago. A story that made a big impression on me. I was going home from yeshiva. I was learning then in Yerushalayim. My father had just come back to Eretz Yisrael. He was the Rav in Pardes Chana. And I was learning in Yerushalayim. And on my way home on Friday, before Shabbos, to my parents, were in Pardes Chana, somebody tells me that in one of the local papers, there were a whole bunch of stories of Reb Arya Levin. So, of course, I bought the paper to read the stories. And most of the stories were centered around how Reb Arya Levin, Hayam Elavei Anashim, he would escort other people. If a person came to his house to visit him, When the person left, he wouldn't say shalom lehitraot and slam the door, but he would escort the person through the little simtaot, the little streets, till they came to the main street, and then he would say shalom lehitraot. When a person came over to him in the street and asked him an address, he wouldn't say yashar yashar, whether he knew or didn't know, but he would, if it wasn't far, he would go with the person till the place and show him where it is. And he said, it's a very big mitzvah to be malava other people. So I came home and I said to my father, I said, I read all these stories. I said, where did Reb Arya learn this mitzvah of being malava other person? So he said, well, we know this halacha by Yaakov and Esav, where they had the fight together. So he hit him on the thigh. From the thigh, we learned that this is a mitzvah to be malava other people, not to leave Vayivosa Yaakov Levado, that he was left alone, not to leave another person alone, that it's a very, very big mitzvah. In the Kabbalah there is, which I don't understand, but they'd say that in Kabbalah, they talk very, very much about the importance of being alive another person. It's a shmira. When a person goes from one city to another, if you walk out with him a few steps, it means the person is not walking alone. And even if it's only a few steps and then the person goes on his own, it's as if the person, you're with them the entire way, and there's a shmira on the other person. My father said it's a very, very big mitzvah to be malava another person. He said, Reb Arya learned it from a young lady. I said, that to me is a chiddush, because today if you'll write that in the Sefer, they'll all exit it, they'll right away they'll erase it, and they'll say he learned it from some Adam Gadol in Yerushalayim, because pasnish to write, but Reb Arya told the truth. He said he told who he learned it from. So I said, what is the story? He said, Reb Arya used to visit the prisoners. One Friday he went to a prison outside of Yerushalayim to visit some of the prisoners that were there. And there was one man who was put in solitude, in Sinuk. Sinuk there aside, but he heard the Toch Kotlei HaKele, in the walls of the Kele, he heard that Reb Arya was coming to visit. So he asked the British officers if he could see the Rav as well. And they allowed him to visit with Reb Arya. So he says to Reb Arya, he said, my wife and I are both victims of the Holocaust, of the Shoah. We both lost our entire families. We met in Cyprus on the way to Eretz Yisrael. We got married. We have two children. He said, I'm in jail now for a pula that he did in the Irgun and the Eitzel against the British. He said, there's no family to visit my house. My friends in the underground are afraid to go near the house because the British are patrolling around to see who will come there. And if anybody comes, they'll immediately arrest him and they'll bring him in for questioning. So he said to Reb Arya, he said, today, before Shabbos, when you go back to Yerushalayim, he said, visit my wife, give her a gerus from me, tell her I'm okay, you saw me, and give a gerus to my children, see that they're okay as well. And Reb Arya promised him, Belineta, that when he goes back to Yerushalayim, he'll visit the wife and the children. He goes back to Yerushalayim, it's getting late already, he starts looking for the address and he can't find it. He's walking through the Simtaot, the Gesalach there, and there was nobody in the street. And as he walks by, in one of the houses there, in the window, there's a woman preparing for Shabbos. So he knocks on the window and he says, I'm Shuldik, excuse me, do you know where this person lives? Excuse me. So the woman looks at the address and she says, wait a few minutes. My father said, Reb Arya said, I don't know why she told me to wait. If she knew where it is, tell me right away, I'm in a hurry. If you don't know, why should I wait? But I waited. And a few minutes later, he saw that she put all her cooking aside. She was in the middle. She walked out. And she said, come with me. And she walked through the Geslach, and he walked after her. And she brought him to the place where this address was. And she says, this is the place. Shabbat Shabbat Shabbos. So he said to her, why did you have to walk the whole way? You could have showed me where it is. You're also in a hurry now before Shabbos. She said, that's what I thought to do. She said, but then I remembered that my father was an Adam Gadol in Yerushalayim. Before he passed away, he called us all to his bedside. And he said, what does a person think of when he's about to leave this world? About the money that he made, the kavod that he had. What does he take with him? He said, he takes with him only the Torah and the Maisim Tovim. So he said to us before he left, he said, I want each and every one of you, he said to the children, to take one mitzvah and make it your special mitzvah. People used to do this. People used to take one mitzvah of all the Tayag mitzvahs and they would make that one mitzvah their special mitzvah. That meant that any other mitzvah, they were nenas, it was an oines, they couldn't do it, they were parted from doing it. But their one special mitzvah, even if it was an oynes, they would make sure that they would do it anyway. They would do whatever they could do to perform that mitzvah, never to miss it. It was their one mitzvah that they would always be sure that they would do it to their entirety. And the reason is, there are many reasons. One is that we say, even when we have many mitzvahs that we do, tariyag mitzvahs hatluyim bo, that one mitzvah, if you do it, it's an entirety, as it really should be done, then it's as if you're mekayim all the mitzvahs together. So people would choose one mitzvah, and that mitzvah, no matter what happened, they would always do that mitzvah. That was their special mitzvah. She said, my father told me this mitzvah of being melav another person. He said, how important the mitzvah it is. And it's a mitzvah that people forget and they don't do. She said, when you came, she said to Rabbi, you came to me today. I realize it's before Shabbos. You're in a hurry. If I point with my finger, you may not find it. I know where it is. I'm going to be melav you till the place. Rabbi thanked her. He visited the woman and the children and gave a gerus from the husband. And before Shabbos, he wrote in his little pinkas, he wrote, today I learned from a young woman how important it is, taka, this mitzvah, to be melava another person. And from today, I take it upon myself, b'li nera, to be mekayim this mitzvah all the time. I heard this story in it. It's mitzvah gefel. I just thought, what a beautiful mitzvah it is to be melava another person. What a nice mitzvah it does. What does it take? And what a wonderful mitzvah. You make a person feel that it's not, that you think of them, that they're important to you. So I said to myself that Shabbos 30 years ago, b'li nera, from now on, I'm going to make this mitzvah mine as well. As much as I can, I'll try. I went back to Yeshiva Motzei Shabbos, Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos. 2 days later, I'm walking in the street in Yerushalayim. It's towards evening. And I see a man walking across the street, an old man. And he's walking back and forth and back and forth looking for something. So I realized, obviously, he lost something or whatever. So I crossed over the street. And I went over to him and I said, Slicha, doni mechapes mashu? Are you looking for something? He said, I'm an old man, he said. He said, I lost my way here. He said, I'm looking for this in this street. So I said to myself, 2 days ago, I said to myself that I'm going to take upon myself this mitzvah to be malava other people. And 2 days later, I'm walking with Shalom. Your Ben Shalom is trying me already. He wants to see, did I really mean it or not? So I said to the old person, what street are you looking for? He tells me. I said, I know where it is. It says, Los Megain Suzaman. So I walk with him to the street. I ask him the number of the house he's looking for. I bring him to the house, and I say to him, Shalom Leitraot. He says to me, Regachad, wait a minute. He says to me, you're a young person. This was 30 years ago. He says to me, why did you come to me, ask me? I said, people don't do this anymore. Why did you come and ask me what I'm looking? He said, why did you do that? I said, I probably wouldn't have done it. I said, but my Zeta used to do this. So I said, I'll do it as well. He said, who is your Zeta? I said, you wouldn't know who he is. He said, who was he? I said, Levin. He said, is it Levin? I said, Arya Levin. He said, Reb Arya Levin? I said, Ken. The old man grabs me by the lapels, and he starts crying. See, the old man starts crying. I didn't know what to say to him. So I stand there, and I wait. And he picks up his head, and he says to me, Vatoyedea mi ani? And do you know who I am? I said, no, I never met you before. He said, my name is Menachem Roi. He said, I write articles in the paper. He said, a few days ago, I wrote a whole bunch of stories about Reb Arya, how he used to be malaveh other people in the street. He said, and today, he said, I'm walking in the street, and I lose my place, I don't know where it is, and who comes and helps me? Reb Arya's grandson. So I said, and you know why? I said, because Reb Arya's grandson read your stories. I said, and I learned from that how important it is to be malaveh another person. Why do I say that? First of all, you know, I tell the story, but when I say it today, unfortunately, especially if I say it to young girls in a school, I always have to say it at the end, but today you have to be careful who you're malave. Years ago, when you said that you saw an Erla Chayid, you're not, you could be malave. Today you have to be very, very careful because you don't know where is the Erla Chayid and where is not. I said, so today, unfortunately, you have to be careful when you be mekayim this mitzvah, that you should do it only in a place when there are a lot of people around, and not go into any simtaot when there's nobody there. But this mitzvah of being alive another person is such a wonderful, wonderful mitzvah. And years ago, I was asked to visit a very wealthy man in New York, a Syrian Jew. And people asked me for tzedakah, if I could visit this person to talk to him about giving money to a certain place. They said, you can't get to this person at all. But we got you 5 minutes with him in a Manhattan office. It's very, very important. So I get to see this man, a very aristocratic, elderly man, business, you can see, there's secretaries, there's people waiting online for him. And he sits down with me and he talks to me, and you can see the man is shakul. There's something, aristocracy is written all over him. He finishes talking to me and he gets up. And usually if you meet somebody in an office, a businessman, whatever, when you finish, you walk out and the secretary says, the elevator's down the hall or whatever, you say shalom, you leave. And this old man, and I see people waiting for him, and this man, every minute is money for him. And the man gets up, this older man, and he walks me out of the room, he walks me down the hall, he presses the button for the elevator, and he waits with me. So I said to him, tell me, why did you do this? So he looked at me and he smiled and he thought for a minute. He said, I don't know. He said, my father used to do this. He said, so I also do it. And I saw him then how important it is, chinuch. What chinuch really is. He didn't even know why, he said, but he remembered this is what his father used to do. And years later, when this guy is a big businessman, and every moment the people are waiting, the secretary is telling him he can't leave a minute, everybody's... And this man walks me out, a young person, what does he have to even look at me, Bechlau? He walks me all the way out, and even because that's what his father used to do. And for me, it was a tremendous limud. We do sometimes little things, and we don't know how much those little things are mashpia on our children. We think we have to do big things for our children so they'll remember. We teach them all kind of mussar and everything else. But those things don't always go over. But little things that they see us do sometimes, when we're malave another person outside, when there are things that remain with them for the rest of their lives, they'll never forget it. How important it is, the little things we do. And my father said something once, a very, very beautiful thing. He was talking about my grandfather, and he said the big things that a person does shows the person's ability. The little things that a person does shows the person's quality. And he explained it this way. He says, you know, if a person is a wealthy man, he's a great doctor, he's a great lawyer. In order to be that great doctor and great lawyer, the man needs to have a lot of ability. You can't just become a great doctor and lawyer or a very wealthy person if you don't have some ability. There has to be some innate ability. But the little things that a person does, he said, shows the person's quality. And he explained it this way in a very beautiful way. He said, how do we measure physical strength? Physical strength we measure by, if I have bigger muscles, I can hit harder than you. If I'm bigger than you, I can hit harder than you. We measure the physical, crude things by how big. He said, but how do we measure the senses? He says, who has a better sense of sight? Somebody that sees a big building across the street? Or somebody that sees something very, very small the further away it is? He said, the further away, the smaller the object, the keener the sense of sight. Who has a better sense of hearing? Somebody that hears a big band playing, or somebody that hears from far away the sigh that comes from another person's heart? The shorter, the smaller, that measures really the acuteness, shows what a person's sense of hearing is. So he says physical strength is measured by how big. He says, but the finer things in life, the echuti things, the things of quality, are not measured by how big. They're measured by how small. The little things that we do for another person, that shows that we think of another person. The little thing that a husband does for his wife, that a wife does for a husband. Not the major things. The little things that say to another person, I'm thinking of you. You're important to me. Those are the things that are important to another person. Those are the things that make love in a household. That show another person how... I always tell when I'm a Sada Kiddushin, I very often will say to a young couple that... I once asked my grandfather to give me a magic word for a young couple that will ensure them a life of happiness. I said, is there a magic word? He said, there is. But he explained it this way. He said, in Gemara, he said in the Talmud, he said, there are the vikuchim, the arguments between the Rabbanim. One Rav says this, one Rav says the other. We have the arguments. But then we have to know practically, what do we do? This Rav says this, this Rav says this. What do we do? Comes halacha. And the halacha is kovei achad mashmai. What do we do? Who do we follow? But he said, there's a mitzvah of mezuzah. Mezuzah, there's machloikas. How do you put the mezuzah on the door? Do you put it standing up or do you put it lying down? So one svar is you put it standing up. The other svar is you put it lying down.
comes halacha and has to decide how do you put the mezuzah on the door. Comes the halacha and says, put it on at its slant. Ba'alachson. What does that mean? Compromise. Halacha, which is chad mashmid, and says, no compromise, this way or the other way. And in mezuzah, the halacha comes and says, put it ba'alachson on a slant. What does that mean, he said? He said, the first mitzvah that a young couple in real come see, when they walk into the new house, what is the first mitzvah that hits them? The mezuzah that's standing on the door. The mezuzah that machriz, that calls to the young couple and says to them, pshara, pshara, pshara. Compromise, compromise, compromise. If you want to live together a wonderful life, then know how it is to beitzach to the other person a little bit. Know how it is to give in to another person. When you see something that's so important to the other person, that you love so much, is important to you, know how to bend sometimes, even if it's something that you want. But you see it's important to the other person, bend to the other person, put it ba'alachson, and then you'll see what a wonderful life you'll have together. Pshara doesn't mean that you give up on your ideals, on your ekronot. No. Pshara means that I think about the other person, that you're important to me. And if there's something that I know is so important to you, then I'm willing to beitzach and to give in to the other person. Because I know that when you realize how something will be important to me, you'll do the same thing for me. I asked my Zeta once, how did you manage to open up so many people, chilonim, non-religious people, to relate to other people and to open up their hearts to so many beautiful things in Yiddishkeit? How did you do it? What was your magic? He said there was once a father and a son that came to a Rebbe, and they were holding a winter coat that they had, one coat. And the father says, Rebbe, we have a coat. It's one coat only that we own. Coming winter now, I need the coat. I'm an old man. I need to have the coat. My son doesn't feel the cold the way that I do. And the son said, Rebbe, my father sits home the whole day, and I go out to bring him parnasa. I go out in the cold. He's at home. I need to have the coat. They're both holding the coat. The Rav can't say the yachloku and cut it in half because then nobody will have a coat. And the Rav has to give an answer. What do you do with this coat that the father needs the coat and the son needs the coat and there's only one coat? And the Rav thinks for a minute and he says, I'll give you an answer tomorrow. Come back tomorrow, I'll give you an answer. But when you come back, each one will tie to the other person's side, will take the other person's side, and then I'll give you an answer. They didn't understand what the Rav wants from them, but they listened. They kept the coat, there's no problem, you both have a coat for the winter. The father looks at this and says, Rebbe, can I ask you one more question? He says, go ahead. When we were here yesterday, was that coat in the closet? He says, yes, the coat was in the closet yesterday. He said, why didn't you give it to us yesterday? Why did we have to come back again today? Rav says, you don't understand. When you came to me yesterday, and the father said, I have a coat and it's mine, and the son said, I have a coat and it's mine, I said, I also have a coat in the closet and it's mine. When you came to me today, and the father says, I have a coat and it's his, and the son said, I have a coat and it's his, I said, I have a coat in the closet and it's yours. He said, if you want to open up another person's heart to yours, kamayim apanim lepanim ken lev ha'adam la'adam. Open up your heart to that other person, and you'll see how wonderful and much magic there will be in the way that other person will open up their heart to yours. And I can tell you that I had so many experiences in my life here in Eretz Yisrael with non-religious people, with people who are anti-religious people, and the way of relating to them like a mensch and giving cover to these people that they're a mensch also and a human being and they have their schiot as well has changed people in such a way that I never in my life believed that it could happen. See, we think that we have to give musa to other people and tell people where they're lo beseder, and by doing that it makes us very, very big tzaddikim and pious people. The real tzaddikim never went around giving musa to other people. The real tzaddikim went around being examples of what they should be. They showed other people what it is to be a good person and how a person should relate to other people. And when other people saw that, they wanted to be like that. It spoke to them. And I saw this. People say to me sometimes, you tell a lot of stories about your grandfather, about Reb Arya, they're wonderful stories. But tell us one incident, and I told this not, I think I told the Shavuos. tell me one incident where you did things your Zeta does, and you learned something for it, and you did it without thinking, and it opened up your eyes to something, just by doing it. And I'll say, I had a story that happened to me, Dafka, about a year ago. I get a call from a Mamlachti Dati school, and the woman, a principal, a woman in the school, she says to me, the school is named after Reb Aryeh Levin, it's very far from here, and we're having an evening dedicated to Reb Aryeh Levin. There'll be a lot of Rabbanim, Anshei Chinuch, very important people will be there, parents will be there from the school, and we wanted to have a guest of honor, and we thought it would be nice to have the grandson of Reb Aryeh come and be the guest of honor and speak at this event. Would you agree to be the guest of honor? I said, when is the event? She said, it's about 8-9 months from now. I said, 8-9 months from now? I said, who thinks about 8-9 months from now? I said, Amir Tzishem. And we'll see, 8-9 months down the line. We'll talk about it then. I said, you know, I don't even have a calendar that goes 8-9 months down the line. So she says, fine. Comes about 7-8 months later. I get a call from the principal and she says, you know, the day is coming nearer now. We're sending out the invitations now. And I hope you're going to be with us. We made a big event. We took a very, very big hall. And a lot of people are going to be there. And we hope you're going to be there. So I said, I hope to be there as well, I said. But I don't know how I'm going to get there. She said, well, you're in Yerushalayim. It's about 4 or 5 buses to get here. 5 buses to get back. She says, take the buses and I'll reimburse you for whatever the buses cost. But make sure you get here because everybody's waiting to meet you. So I say, thank you very much. I close the phone. I says, I'm Mudnezach, you know. You invite somebody to be guest of honor. You're taking a big haul. And you tell the person, get on 5 buses, 2-3 hours schlepping to get there and to get back. I said, if I invited a guest of honor, which I did at times when I ran seminars for young people, and that I would invite a Rav or somebody, anybody to come. So I would have a taxi, take them and bring them back. And if you didn't have money, maybe they don't have money in the school. So I would ask a friend, you have a car, do me a favor, it's not nice. I asked the person to come, he's not getting anything for it, he's just coming, he's doing us a favor. Go and pick him up and bring him back. I mean, that's the normal protocol you do. Tells me 5 buses take 5 minutes. Okay. Comes the day of the event. And I had a very difficult day. I had to spend the day in the hospital with someone, or I had a problem, whatever. It's towards the end of the day. I come home, it's late already. The weather was terrible. I had just had, 2 or 3 months before, I had a dalekit reyot, I had pneumonia. My wife says to me, you're not going. She said, well, Mr. Meshuggah, you're crazy now? You're going to go now on 5 buses to go there? You're not even going to make it on time, she said. You're going to go there and you're going to go back? I said, it's ridiculous. I said, you're right, I feel the same way. I have no koyach to go. He said, but I feel bad, you know. I said, yes, I made a mistake. I should have said, you know, if you'll try transportation, whatever. I said, they put my name on the card. She says, I feel bad not going. What does my wife do? She's worried about my gesund, so she goes and calls up the school, without telling me even, and she gets the assistant principal. And she says to the assistant principal, my husband will not be here this evening, because I cannot see him getting on 5 buses now to get to this place in such weather and everything else. It's ridiculous. He was not well before. I just can't see it. Thinking, when she said this, that the assistant principal is going to say, oh, I understand, it's late already, he wasn't feeling well. Let him take a cab. We'll take care of it. It's no problem. Instead, the assistant principal starts yelling at my wife on the phone. Chilul Hashem. This is a Chilul Hashem. We invited him as the guest of honor. We put his name on the thing. He's not coming. It's going to spoil the whole evening. How can a grandson of Reb Aryeh Levin the Tzaddik do a thing like this? This is a terrible Chilul Hashem. I've never heard of anything like that. She starts yelling at my wife. So my wife says to her, what would you do if your husband had to go now on 5 buses and didn't feel well? Would you let him? She says, Wayamagia al alba. He would get there on 4. My wife says to me, that's it. You're not going. She said, if this is the yachas to you, you're coming to do a favor to be a guest of honor. This is the yachas to you, that you should get there and offer Chilul Hashem and everything else. What do they want from you? She said, you're not going. I said, you're right, I feel the same way. It's mige grijet abisl. I still felt this, not, I told him I'm coming, it's my fault. I should have said maybe right away, I'll come if you provide transportation. I didn't say that. So there was a misunderstanding. Maybe it's my fault. I said, I don't want to make a chilul Hashem. They'll say, Nechet shel Rabbi Levin asa chilul Hashem. I don't want to be the cause of a chilul Hashem. I said what the Israelis say, achalti yota. It's my mistake. I made a mistake. I said, I'll take a cab because I won't get there any other way. I'll pay for the cab. I won't say anything. And I'll get there and I'll do what I have to do and I'll come home. I call a cab. I go to the place. I come to the ulam. It's a very beautiful ulam that they took. Must have been very, very expensive, an ulam like that for an evening. There's a few hundred people sitting in the ulam. And I'm called up to say a few words. So as I go up, I say, what would my Zayda do in such a situation? I say, what would Reb Aryeh do in such a situation? I didn't know what to do. So I go up and I say, before I say anything about Reb Aryeh, I want to tell you all a story. I want to tell you all in the Sulam this evening why I'm here this evening. I said, I was not feeling well. My wife was worried about my gesund, so she called up your assistant principal and told her that I would not be here this evening. I'm telling this in the auditorium. So I tell them, I said to my wife, what did the assistant principal say when you told her that? So I said, my wife said, the assistant principal said, what? He doesn't feel well? Of course he shouldn't come tonight and get on 5 buses. Don't let him, you shouldn't let him do that. If he's not feeling well, how can he get on 5 buses now? Take care of him, let him be well. We're disappointed because we expected him here, but we wish him all the best. We be mispalo for him here. We'll make our mishaberach for him and everything else and that. Just make sure that he should be well. There'll be other events. We'll invite him. So I'm telling this in the auditorium. So I said to my wife, look how the assistant principal of the Rabbi Levine School answered you. I said, any other principal would have said, chilul Hashem, it's not nice. You should get there on all four. And you're telling me that the assistant principal of the Rabbi Levine School said to you, the person comes before the event, he should be well, that's the most important thing. I said, that's what Rabbi Levine himself would have said. I said, if that's the case, I said to my wife, even feeling the way I do, I have to be in that school this evening. I said, and that's why I'm here this evening. Everybody got up in the auditorium, they all started applauding. About 10, 15 minutes, everybody started applauding. Anyway, I went through the evening, there was all kinds of speeches, whatever, this and that. I came home at night. It was Thursday night. I was oiskemuchet with the cab both ways. Next day, Friday, Erev Shabbos, Billy Guzman, literally, 5 minutes before Shabbos, my wife gets a phone call. She says to me, you know who that was? I said, no. So it was the assistant principal. I said, what does she want? She said, you're the wife of Binyamin Levine. I said, yeah. She said, I'm the assistant principal that spoke to you yesterday. I called up to apologize the way that I spoke to you yesterday. It was very not nice. I should never have talked like that. I'm embarrassed by it. And I called up to say, I'm sorry. So I said to my wife, you know, the whole thing was worth it. I said, in that ulam last night, everybody in the ulam said, what a wonderful person that assistant principal is. Look how she answered him when he called up. She said, you should be well. And the only two people that knew the truth was myself and that woman. I'm sure that it bothered her the whole day. 5 minutes before Shabbos, she said, I can't go into Shabbos feeling like this anymore. It's too much already. She called up and she apologized. She said, what did I learn from this? I said, first of all, I'm sure she's a wonderful person. And I'm sure under the pressure of setting up this whole evening, she, at the last moment, anybody who would be setting up something like this, at the last moment, the guest speaker is not going to show. You would feel terrible. I worked so hard in this and everything else. I said, we all go through the same things. We all lose it sometimes. And it's a normal thing. Tzaddikim lose it sometime. I said, I understood. I had done a lakafsus. I'm sure she's a wonderful person. And that moment, it was very difficult for her. After all she worked on, to hear the guest speaker's not going to be there. So that I understand, I said. But you know what I really learned from that evening last night? I said to my wife, I said that this is the way you have to give musar. Musar is not telling a person, you were bad, you did a terrible thing, you shouldn't have done it. Real musar is painting a picture for another person. Look how you could have acted. If you would have acted like this, how would you have felt? And how would that whole evening have been? And when you show another person a picture of how you could have acted, and how nice it would have been if you would have been menschlich to the other person, and you would have acted in such a nice, noble way, what you do to that other person is you make them feel, I want to be like that. You lift that person up and you make them want to be a better person. And that's what real Musar is. We give young kids today Musar, and we give them Musar, it's okay. We give young people, so it's good. That's what kids are supposed to do. We give kids Musar, and we don't understand how damaging sometimes that Musar is. My father told me when he was a young kid in Eitz Chaim, Rebbe Zalman Meltzer, he said, when all the Gedolim used to come to give a faher in the yeshiva, in the cheder, anything a kid said, they said, Zeh gut. It was wonderful. The kid made the wrong answer. They would say, what a good answer. What you meant to say was this and this and this, and then they said the right answer. He said, every kid who gave an answer on a faher, when the Gedolim came, every kid always said the right thing. He said, never, a kid never made a mistake. He said, you know what those kids said? He said, when other Rabbanim came, were not in the same caliber, they would catch the kids. It's not like this. It's not like this. It's not. He said, but when the real Gedolim came, he said, anybody who gave an answer, it was right. Didn't matter what they said. They made it right. He said, and that kid, he said, felt that Gadol asked me a question and I said it right. You know how that made them feel? I can go on now and I can really become a Gadol myself. Because I said that Gadol was happy with what I said. He saw that I said the right thing. You know what a wonderful thing that is? That positive thing of making a person feel that they're capable of doing it. Even if you have to give Musa to another person, but saying in a way where you paint the picture and you show the other person without denigrating the other person, without pulling the other person down, but showing how the person could have been, and the other person realizes it. Nobody told this person to call up. But she understood afterwards that what she did was not the right thing. And probably the whole Friday she wanted to call up. She was embarrassed. It was hard for her. Before Shabbos she had to do it. That's how you give Musa to another person. Rabbi Levine's way of talking to another person, of giving Musa to another person, was never making that person feel they were no good or they were bad or whatever. It was always making that person feel they were a wonderful person. They were a special person. And they had a tremendous keches. And one of the reasons we're suffering so much today in our society, in the Frum society, is because we're not doing it right. We're taking young kids, we're trying to make them into what they're not, and we're trying to force them to do things instead of giving them love and showing them what it means to have a wonderful home life and to be happy. And we all make mistakes, and sometimes we're not the way we should be, and it's not a terrible thing. In Yerushalayim, you know what they used to say? They used to say, "Akosher in Purim and Afreilich in Pesach." That's what they used to say. Why Purim kasher and Pesach sameach? Because Purim, they used to say, people get drunk. And at Purim, they say when they get drunk, things they shouldn't say. So it should be Akosher in Purim. Your Purim, when you get drunk, should be kosher. It shouldn't bring you to say things you shouldn't say. Pesach, with all the halachas and the chumras, we go so meshuggah, we forget about the happiness of Pesach and the simcha. So we say Afreilich and Pesach. Because kosher it'll be. But to go meshuggah and to make it all and then afterwards to come miserable to Pesach, to make it to be a kosher Pesach and it's all miserable, that is not a kosher and Pesach. It has to be Afreilich and Pesach as well. We forget and we lose the ikar of what these things are. And that's why I felt, I think we went over the time, is that enough? It's time. Shen genug, right? No, but you have to know when to stop also.
I want to hear the story that your father...
The story of my father is a story that I got a call about a year ago from America. The person says to me, we write these books called Chicken Soup for the Soul. The person says to me, calls me, I don't know who he is or whatever. He says, we're putting out a book now, Chicken Soup for the Jewish Soul. Some rabbi told that story in your name about your father. Could we print the story? What was the story? My father was a Rav in Seattle, Washington. He got stuck in Seattle at the time when he got stuck in America, getting a green card, crossing out of America into Vancouver to come back. I was born in Seattle. He was a Rav there for 12 years. But my brothers were growing up, and he wanted to be closer to the yeshivas, so he moved to New Jersey. He moved to the East Coast. Rav Henkin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was in New York. He loved my father very much, and he said to him, there's a shtela now in Jersey City, New Jersey. I don't know, those of you who know what America was like in the 50s and that, when I was growing up in that, It was not like today where you live in a Fruma section and everybody lives with Fruma Yidden and everything. You lived there. My father was a rav of community there and that. I lived on a block all of Goyim. There were all Goyim all around us and everything else. So, but it was a very beautiful community at the time, one of the most beautiful shuls in America at the time. In the 50s this was. It was in the 50s. And Rav Henkin said to my father, there's a shtela now in New Jersey. The rav just passed away. Rav Bloch, he was a very big Talmud Chacham. And they're looking for a rav. He said, I want you to go and try out for the shtela. So my father went, and he went there for Shabbos, and then they called him back again. This was not written in the story, but there's another story that happened at the time, is they called my father back for another Shabbos, and they made a mistake. That same Shabbos, they called another big Talmud Chacham, a big rav, for the same Shabbos. And all of a sudden, the president of the shul didn't know what to do. He has two big gedolim, two big talmidei chachamim, and they're both there. One of them has to speak, and they don't know what to do. So my father saw that there was a problem, so he said to the president, maybe I can help you out. Let me take care of it. So the president was very happy. He said to my father, if you can help me out, I'll be very indebted to you. I don't know what to do. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to embarrass anybody. So my father got up on the bima in time for the drasha, and he introduced the other rav. And he told everyone what a great man this other Rav was. What a really Adam Gadol this other person was. And that any community that would get such a person like this would be gebenched, would be blessed. And he called up the other person to give the drasha that Shabbos. Well, the people in the shul were so taken with what he did that they said, we want him to be the Rav of the shul. So they called in my father and they said, we would like you to be the Rav. My father said, I can't give you an answer now. I'll give you an answer in another week or two. They looked at this very, very funny. I know here, he needs the parnasa. There were over 100 candidates trying the position. They told my father, you're the candidate. Instead of saying thank you, he says, I'll give you an answer in a week. So nobody even knew why this happened. But what happened was, I learned from the old Rebbetzin who was in the shul. She was still alive, the almana of the Friedike Rav, of the old Rabbi Bloch. My father used to go to visit her every Friday before Shabbos. I remember she lived in a bitum somewhere. It was a lot of steps. I once fell down the steps, so I remember how many steps there were. But I was a little boy. My father would take me with him on Friday morning to visit the old Rebbetzin, and he would tell her what's going on in the shul and whatever, see if she needed anything. And one Friday morning, he took me to her, and he was talking to her, and then he had to go visit someone. So he asked the old Rebbetzin if he could leave me with her, and he'll come back to fetch me, to get me in a little while. So she gave me some soda and some cookies, and she said to me, I'm going to tell you a story I don't want you ever to forget. I want you always to remember this. And it really remained with me. It was a limud for me. She said, when your father came here to try out for the position, she said there were a lot of candidates, and then they said to your father they want him to be the Rav, but he said, I'll give you an answer in a week. And nobody knows why he said that. He said, but I know the answer. He said, because he came to see me. And he said to me, the old Rebbetzin said, I know that you were always the first lady of the community, the Rebbetzin of the community. It'll be very hard for you now to see another Rav in your husband's position after all these years. They've asked me to be the Rav, but I didn't give an answer. I've come first to ask your permission. If you agree, then I'll go back and I'll take the shtela. But if you feel in any way you don't want me to be here, I'll leave right away. So the old Rebbetzin told me that she started to cry. And she said, Tak, I said to myself, how will it be now after all these years to see somebody else in my husband's position? But that you should come to ask me my permission, who asks me anything anymore? Who relates to me anymore? You should come to ask my haskama? She said, not only did I want you to stay, but I feel as if my own son is taking the position. She said, only then did he go back and take the position. And for the first year, he didn't sit in the rough seat. And I said that this lesson to me was a lesson that was worth more than 10 musas for him or whatever, because it taught me how we have to relate to other people. And that if you get a position or if you get something that is on somebody else's cheshbon, then it's not worth it at all. My father was willing to get up and leave at that moment if he felt that she didn't want him to be here. But he thought, how could he take the position without first asking her permission when she was the Rebbetzin so many years in the community? That's the way that we have to relate to other people. And that's the chesed, that when we do it, that brings gula to the world. It's the sensitivity that these people had. Sometimes people didn't understand things that they did, but it came from tremendous sensitivity of not hurting another person, not going into machloikis anywhere there was a machlokes, they ran away from a machlokes. It was the sensitivity of thinking about another person. There was an old dayan in Yerushalayim, Reb Michal Dayan. He had to go away for a period of time. He was not well. And when he left, my grandfather, Rabbi, ran to get his position. And everybody said, Rabbi, the big tzaddik is going to get a position that has with it money. You can make money out of it. Had this old Rav's position, that's what he's getting. He had to leave for a while. When the old Rav came back, Rabbi went to see him and said, now take back your position. So he said, Rabbi, why did you take the position? There was a young dayan that wanted very much to take this position. And Rabbi saw that if this young dayan becomes the dayan in his place, when Reb Michal comes back, there's not going to be position for him anymore. So Rabbi went and watched the position for him for a year, so that then he didn't need it, he didn't want it even. But he knew that when this old Reb Michal dayan came back and needed the parnasa, there would still be a parnasa waiting for him. And the other person wouldn't have had it, it would still be open for him to take back. It's being able to think ahead, to think of another person, to feel for another person. I think that really is the tzavasha of today. See, with all the wonderful learning that's going on, and we're living in a time that's a wonderful time. We have to be makir tov, the time we're living in as well. There's never been a time that so much Torah has been learning, that so many people are coming back to Yiddishkeit and feeling for Yiddishkeit. It's a renaissance of that never existed ever before. The Torah world that we have today, it's an amazing, wonderful thing. But we also have to remember that part of it also is the way that we relate to other people. My Zeta used to say, with this I'll end, it's really late already. Shila Malas, Esa Ene Ela Horim, Me Ayin Yova Yezri. I look up to the mountains, from whence will my help come? He said, if I'm David HaMelech, who really wants to look up high, doesn't have to look up to the mountains. The stars, the moon, the sun are much higher than the mountains. Why does David HaMelech look up to the mountains? If you're looking for heights, you got things much higher. He said, because the sun and the moon and the stars are all anchored, they're in the heavens. But a mountain stands on the ground and it strives to reach the heavens. He said, the Rebbeinu Shlem doesn't want us to be in the heavens. Hashemayim Shemayim Lashem, Baritz Nasan of Nei Adam. Eso Eine Ela Horim, the Rebbeinu Shlem wants us to be like a mountain. He wants us to stand on the ground. He wants us to strive in heights to reach higher and higher all the time. But he wants us to be on the ground. He wants us to see the people around us. He wants us to have our eyes open where we can help somebody else and do a chesed for somebody else. That's what the Rebbeinu Shlem wants from us. He wants normalcy. He wants us to relate to other people. And he wants the Torah to be a Torah, not only that we learn, but that we live as well. And Amir Tzeshem, if we're zeichet to these things, by the chesed, by the Torah that we learn, and by the Torah that we practice, by doing chesed for other people, will Amir Tzeshem be met vizeichet to Geula Shleima, to a year of Tachel Shana Berchoteha, Techle Shana Vekilaloteha, Tachel Shana Berchoteha, and really have a gebenshin and a wonderful new year. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Stay tuned for our next year.
I'm going to make you come back.
Better when you help.
We finished, yeah.
Excuse me?
Please work your steps.
My mother, we're from Gibraltar,
going inside
and she read
and
the
cold drink
book of Tzadik in Our Time, and she was so impressed by it, she called my brother after
Really?